First colloquium of this fall term, and here is a provisional schedule of the colloquium for the rest of the term. And I won't go through all of it, but let me mention that we are planning on having two of these bistro sessions that we did last year, which people like quite a lot. And the first one on October 8th will be for introducing the new postdoc. So if you are a new postdoc, this is a heads up that we'll be asking you to say 2 or 3 minutes about yourself and your work at that talk. We don't have a talk next week, but then we have two more in September, Jos Ulflink on Foundations of Quantum Mechanics, and a talk at an unusual time, September 30th, which is a Tuesday at 11 a.m. on condensed matter, and I apologize not to have the name of the person. Very good. For people who don't know it, while we're at a conference on partly related to technology and science, all the talks at the conference, as well as almost every talk that's given here, is available on the internet at a site called PERSA. And so for those of you who are new to Perimeter, that's our modest attempt to do for talks what the archive has done so well for papers. Okay, well, I'm very, very pleased to introduce David Kaiser here. David is a historian of science and a historian of 20th century science. He originally was a physicist, in fact, worked in cosmology and overlap with elementary particle physics, and did also part of his PhD, and he can explain to us how he managed to do both in history of science. He has recently a book called Drawing Theories Apart, The Dispersion of Feynman Diagrams, and there are two or three puns in that I stumbled over in post-war physics. He's one of the most prominent of contemporary historians of science, and this is something that I think is a very good direction, who are professionally trained in the areas that they study. And although there's lots of fascinating things about the 17th century and the 19th century and so forth, are doing scholarship on the period that directly precedes us, from which we have much to learn. So we look forward to his talk and welcome him.
Well, thank you very much. Is the microphone on? Okay. Thank you very much. It's a great thrill to be here. I want to thank the conference organizers, Sabine, Michael, and Lee. I've been enjoying this conference immensely so far, and we're only halfway done, so that bodes well. I'm going to talk today about a book that I'm in the middle of. I've been in the middle of this book for 2 years, so I keep writing a lot, but the book keeps expanding, so it's some kind of scaling problem. But I do want to talk, I suggest that it is certainly a historical work. I think it will have some resonance and perhaps some interest, if not direct policy implications, even today. So I'm writing this about recent past, and I think it has things even for us right now. By way of prologue, Lee just mentioned my earlier book, tell you where I'm coming from intellectually. This book came out about 3 years ago. And what really has fascinated me in that first book, certainly in the book I'm going to talk with you about today, is this notion of training. What do we get as, what do we learn as historians or sociologists by focusing on the active process of making new scientists, right? What if we focus our intense analytic gaze there? Will that help us understand, we can take that in many directions, to understand changing policies and politics surrounding science, understand the institutions and how they are indeed are involving the expectations, and then understand what role this has in the sort of more technical developments of the trajectories that the research then begins to follow. I find this a really quite exciting angle on things. I put up here what was no doubt only a coincidence. This book was released the same date a couple of summers ago as this other little-known book by J.K. Rowling called Harry Potter. It was volume 6 of that. for some reason, all of my communications to Rowling bounced. I was inviting her to do a joint book tour. She didn't take the bait. But the books, it's too bad. I mean, I don't mean to be overly pedantic. It's possible some in the room don't know this book. I take it for granted you know this one, of course. But this one might be foreign to you. And they're really quite similar. They're both really about apprenticeship, about learning to do magic, right? What looks like magic to outsiders. That's certainly how people reacted upon watching Feynman doodle these diagrams on the board. That must be magic. It's about mastering these skills. So in fact, the books are quite similar. And other similarities, this one has sold 120 million copies, and this one has sold 1,200. Same numbers with a few zeros, but remarkable, stunning similarities. So that's in a sense where I'm coming from. The current book that I'm going to talk about, it begins and ends in the very, very recent past, two or three years ago, not 50. And this is a report that some of you may already know about. I should say the book, like this talk, focuses mostly on the United examples from the United States, not exclusively. And I will try to gesture here, do it more explicitly in the book, how I think this also has relevance to a great many other countries, the trends in other countries that I'll try to spell out here. It'll be quite clipped for time. But the talk will be, again, sort of, I apologize, it's mostly U.S.-centric, but I think it has lessons there too. So in the United States, you can tell it's the United States because we have all these draped American flags all over the place. So the National Academy of Sciences released a report approximately 2 years ago entitled Rising Above the Gathering Storm. You can probably, on this screen, you probably make out even the subtitle, Energizing and Employing America for a Brighter Economic Future. The core of the argument was that the United States was training far too few scientists and engineers to meet the sort of economic innovation demands of the new millennium. And in particular, we were falling dramatically behind other now newly risen competitors, especially India and China. And so the report is full of numbers like this. If you look at new engineers trained in the year 2004, where trained means, roughly speaking, people who received a bachelor's or bachelor's of science or more advanced degrees. Definitions vary. But some form of sort of new people entering the technical and scientific workforce. China purportedly had introduced 350,000 just that year, and the United States had introduced 140,000. This was not only a report from the National Academy of Sciences, it was picked up by this gentleman, who will be known to you. It was featured in the 2006 State of the Union Address, where President Bush launched this thing called the American Competitiveness Initiative, which was, again, to say the economic advantage of the United States is imperiled if we don't have enough new people who can make new widgets to make the economy grow, roughly speaking. The report itself, and certainly the presidential stamp of approval, received very widespread coverage in a variety of types of media. Mainstream newspapers covered it with blaring headlines. The New York Times picked it up this way. Newsweek, Wired magazine, more sort of technically oriented magazines, and indeed many, many more I didn't bother showing. What's interesting is that the numbers here would bounce around between both between governmental reports and news reports. So some would say 350,000, maybe it was 320,000, maybe it was 370,000, maybe the U.S. had 60,000. Right? Already we start to see there's something going on with those numbers that perhaps should have perked up one's ears. But nonetheless, the report and its imprimatur were you know, taken quite seriously. Now this is stunning to me as an historian. Because if we do a very simple experiment, not too different, in fact, from Harry Collins' imposter experiment that he told us about this morning, you could take a not very sophisticated program like Microsoft Word and do search and replace economic competitiveness with national security, replace China, India for Soviet Union, and then you can do a test. Say, could anyone tell whether that report was written in 2006 or 1956? And I bet we'd all fail. The reports are astonishingly similar to a whole slew of frenzy of activity, government reports, media coverage, from the period just prior to and indeed after the surprise launch of Sputnik, roughly 50 years ago. And with equally blaring headlines from major newspapers, large coverage and so on. And then as now, the theme was that the United States is imperiled by a critical shortage of technically trained people and we're losing a particular type of race. It was then called a manpower race, a very gendered term, but basically a numbers game. Do we have enough people entering the workforce? So I spent a lot of my time staring at this blue curve. This is really the leitmotif for the whole book, and I'll be saying much about it. But what I want to do is look at this curve. This is the number showing the number of PhDs in physics granted in the United States over time. And so we can really read off the sort of political economy of the Cold War from this graph, right, from its bumps and wiggles. Extraordinarily rapid growth coming out of World War II. That makes some sense given the importance of things like radar and the atomic bomb and the whole massive buildup of an infrastructure for science technology during the war. We see a very rapid rise in the years soon after Sputnik. What's more often forgotten, I'll say something about, is this eerily symmetrical fall, this falling off the cliff starting roughly 1970. I like this curve, or I focus on this curve. I think this gives us an important entree into much broader trends well beyond the United States and well beyond physics. Sticking within the United States for a moment, we can see this insert graph. It might be harder to read. I've taken all PhDs in all fields granted in the United States over the same time period and normalized it. So we can see, just as a quick, rough sort of rates of change argument, we can go over the details if you'd like. All fields were going exponentially in terms of, say, graduate enrollments or graduate degrees after World War II. Things like the GI Bill, there was a huge push, an incentive structure, an importance to get lots of people into higher education, many opportunities for people who wouldn't have had it before. Every field grew. Sociology grew, doubling its graduates every 3 years. History grew every 3 years. The difference is physics grew, doubled every 1.5 years, 1.7 years. So they all grew exponentially. Physics had the steepest exponent. Likewise, there was a general decline across virtually every field, starting again roughly 1970. Physics happened to fall, steepest, hardest, fastest. So it becomes the sort of bellwether for much more broad trends. And this is now in the United States. Again, just a quick footnote. One might say, oh, well, this is just a general sort of demographic effect. We know about baby boomers and all of them entering higher education. That's actually exactly out of phase. That can't be the explanation. Baby boomers, the first wave of baby boom generation was hitting undergraduate classrooms in approximately 1963, 64. They're hitting PhDs presumably a couple years after that. And in fact, that's exactly when things are falling apart. So it's not just more people in the mix. It's a series, as we'll see, of a very overt, very carefully put into place policies. It's a policy decision, not just more people in the mix. And again, I can say more if you'd like afterwards, but similar graphs can be made for Britain, for Canada, for actually a larger number of places that have these kinds of features. It's a larger Cold War-type phenomenon, not unique to physics, not unique to the United States. Physics in the United States experiences the most dramatic versions of them all. So it's like a caricature. Yeah, Paul. No, it's been granted by U.S. institutions. I should say, though, in this physics graph, that's an important question, at no point in this part of the curve was more than 10% of those degrees given to people who weren't already U.S. citizens. I'll come to say more about that later. In this period, in fact, it was in physics departments, it was very difficult for non-citizens, in fact, to get into graduate school, even to do unclassified work at national laboratories. For a long time, you had to be a U.S. citizen to even get a visitor's pass, right? Those things change later. Immigration quota changes later. But for this period, this is virtually 100%, about 90% U.S. citizens. It's certainly all U.S. institutions. Okay. So the talk has three parts. The first part is this notion of a speculative bubble. Does the shape of that curve give us any reason for pause? Now, when we talk about speculative bubbles, I at least often have this kind of picture in mind, this sort of crazy human mass of kind of mosh pit of a trading, of a stock exchange. And this sort of frenzy, which many of us are familiar with and perhaps still shed tears over, from NASDAQ, perhaps more recently from real estate bubbles. Does that notion of a speculative bubble have any purchase on these sort of longer timescale trends in science policy or higher education? And then I'll spend about an equal amount of time on this middle part, which quite frankly I find most fascinating. Does any of that stuff matter to the world of ideas? Do these very violent swings in enrollments or degrees granted and so on, does that shape what we call physics and not just whether this cohort of physicists had a hard time on the job market or not? And I'll introduce some reasons why I think it does. And then very briefly at the end, say, are we with this backdrop in mind, can we come again to these reports like Rising Above the Gathering Storm with perhaps some new clarity? This slide is almost irrelevant now or unneeded after Andrew Odlisko's talk yesterday, which we already heard a lot about bubbles, speculative bubbles. And his favorite example was clearly the British railway system, the 1840s. We can all put our favorite ones on the map. There's an economist at Yale, Robert Shiller, who wrote, I think, a very nice, I wouldn't call it popular book, but an accessible book for non-economists like myself. And he goes through this sort of academic puzzle. Why do speculative bubbles happen, right? Isn't that a challenge to what we think about how economists think about human behavior? And so borrowing from Shiller, he defines what does he mean, at least, by a speculative bubble? And here's a quotation. A situation in which temporarily high prices are sustained largely by investors' enthusiasm rather than by consistent estimation of real value. There's a similar book by some of our colleagues, Harry's and my colleague Donald McKenzie, a quite marvelous sociologist of science, going through some of these similar themes, and I can recommend that to you as well. And just to remind us, here's, say, NASDAQ in recent years. Here's what Shiller has in mind. What he identifies, and what I especially like about his book, he gives a mechanism to this. These speculative bubbles don't just happen. There seems to be a pattern to them, at least in his analysis. And he isolates the roles of hype, amplification, and feedback loops. And we'll come back to each of those in the particular story here about these burgeoning science enrollments after the war. There was great effort given and great attention given, even before Sputnik in this country, to trying to assess exactly this question of how many technically trained people are the Soviets producing per year. There are these three main books, each of these books several hundred pages long, lots of dense appendices, very methodologically sophisticated, certainly for their time. The books share many features in common. The two authors, Nicholas DeWitt and Alexander Korol, were both themselves expatriates from Russia and or the Soviet Union. One, I think, had left quite early. They both received part or all of their engineering training in their homeland before coming to the United States. They both made their way, as they left Russia and the Soviet Union, they made their way eventually to Cambridge, Massachusetts. So DeWitt was at the very was one of the earliest scholars at Harvard's brand new Russian Research Center. Korol was at the equally brand new MIT Center for International Studies. And they share at least one other thing in common. Now we know, it was not clear at the time, both of these studies and their centers were actually heavily underfunded secretly by the CIA for reasons that needn't shock us now. We need to have, what are they doing? We need experts here to tell us what they, the Soviets, are doing. These books and their scholars were very well received in their day. DeWitt was called an indefatigable digger in the New York Times, and Korol was called fastidious. These were careful studies by serious, careful scholars. They also urged care, both Korol and DeWitt, urged a great deal of care when asking the question about sort of comparative studies, anything like these raw numbers, statistics about numbers of degrees or so on. They said it had to be handled with extraordinary care. There's all kinds of things standing in the way. DeWitt even added a whole appendix just on how basically not to abuse these statistics. We'll see that no one read the appendix. He called this the perplexities and pitfalls of working with this particular set of social scientific data. And this is long before they broach anything like numbers. So DeWitt elucidates several points. Korol's very similar, in fact. For one, a large fraction of these Soviet engineers are not working anywhere near research and development. They might have gotten a degree in some technical field, but they're working as bureaucrats, perhaps in an unrelated area. Number two, both of these scholars report, the Soviet training system is marked by extraordinary specialization, even by sort of US or British standards, which was going through a wave of heightened specialization. And to give an example of that, DeWitt marches through, you didn't get a degree in metallurgy in the Soviet system at the time. You didn't even get a degree in non-ferrous metals metallurgy. You got a degree in one of the 11 sub-portions of that portion, which is a portion of metallurgy, right? So they didn't train metallurgists, at least according to this analysis. They trained experts in precious metals refining. There's a marvelous example of this a historical book by one of my colleagues, Lauren Graham, using a sort of biography of a particularly tragic figure, but it really gives us a snapshot of the Soviet technical training at the time. And even more, I think, sort of funny, both DeWitt and Korol emphasize they had all kinds of reasons to believe that academic standards were actively raised and lowered when it looked like so-called production quotas would be missed. Remember, this is the era of Stalinist five-year plans. Stalin or other bureaucrats would say, you know, our institutes will produce this many engineers by this year. And if it looked like the institutes were falling short, they'd sort of push a bunch more people through who would get degrees, even if it meant lowering standards to do so. And they had sort of interesting data on why they believed that. And then again, especially DeWitt in his studies, says, look at more and more of these students who are showing up in these charts, degree holders, are not full-time students in the Soviet case. They're either extensions, sort of like night class students, or increasingly correspondence students. That they are literally working at some factory job, full-time factory job, somewhere in the countryside, and exchanging letters with some professor who's shepherding nearly 100 of these correspondence students through, and that's where they're getting an engineering degree, let alone sort of literary theory or something more obviously text-based. But your degree might indeed have been, you earned your degree armed with a textbook and a mailbox. And that those students are rapidly growing as a proportion of all those numbers in the charts he's about to show us. So all kinds of reasons to say, let's not get lost in a one-for-one comparison of the types of degrees. With those caveats on the table, DeWitt begins to show us some numbers. Korol, even in a 300-page book, never produces a table of side-by-side numbers precisely because he fears they'll be so misused. He says he doesn't want to encourage unwarranted implications. DeWitt does so, but after, you know, really sort of painstaking sort of nuance, plus extra appendices and so on. Once he does show us the numbers, I've simplified them to give you his ratios here, he finds some interesting trends. Annual degrees in higher education, basically university training, BAs and higher. Full-time students, the United States has a sizable margin of lead over the Soviets at the time. He does a few studies, it's basically from the mid-50s through the early 1960s. The trends held pretty steady. If you include all those extension and correspondence, the letter students into the Soviet tally, the United States still maintains a total numerical lead in number of students. But here's where the rub comes. A minority of the students in the United States are studying fields in science and engineering or technical fields, and a large majority in the Soviet Union are doing so. You combine these two parts, and you produce a ratio that the Soviets seem to be graduating 2 to 3 times more students per year in these technical areas than in the United States. And then he says, but you know, definitions vary, degrees aren't the same, but all that on the table, here's the trend we seem to find. Now we find the first of Schiller's three sort of mechanisms start to really take off. One of them we'll call simply hype. 2 to 3 times, right? The second of DeWitt's books was about 900 pages. It was about the same size as Harry's most recent book, with the same number of technical appendices. And these are thick bricks of scholarship, which doesn't always translate well to the Oval Office, or indeed to the press rooms, right? So the phrase 2 to 3 times as many gets ripped, literally yanked out of context immediately and fervently. We see that, and I should say not entirely innocently, in my opinion. So we see very high-ranking members of very important bureaucracies grab that ratio in basically public relations campaigns. You can read their quotations that get very wide coverage, public lectures and so on. You can read them in the context of this legislative battle that's ongoing here. They're speaking in time with a particular audience in mind, and this becomes very useful for them. So director of the CIA starts making very well-covered speeches. High-ranking sort of assistant secretaries in the Department of Defense, members of the Joint Congressional Committee on Atomic Energy. Indeed, the commissioner of the Atomic Energy Commission, shown here, Strauss, who also helped sort of initiate the fight against Oppenheimer. Here he is briefing Dwight Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, on this so-called manpower gap. We're losing 2 to 3 times as many graduates per year to those pesky Russians. And again, huge amount of attention to these reports. This is all the first reports coming out even before Sputnik, right? And then you can imagine what happens after Sputnik in October of 1957, where these findings are still fresh, already in the mix, and become amplified, step two in Schiller's kind of model. And here, what caught my attention was the more active role of a number of leading physicists in using this quite, I think, quite effectively to further goals that might indeed have been lofty. But the reasoning behind the goals, I think we can see, was good old-fashioned politicking, or the kind that happens all the time. So we look at Nobel laureate Isidore Rabi, close to our hearts, at this time chair of the newly founded Presidential Science Advisory Committee. And roughly 1 week after Sputnik, there's by now a well-known secret meeting held in the Oval Office of about a dozen advisors. This PSAC was actually quite new. Rabi was chairing it. Rabi already knew Eisenhower personally from their days at Columbia University. They were already sort of chummy. And his, look, here's our chance, you know, Ike, here's our chance to use Sputnik as a pretext for closing this now well-studied manpower gap, this 2 to 3 times thing. Sputnik might not have been the manpower gap might not have been the cause for our weakness in the space race, but we can use it as such. The president, or director rather, of the American Institute of Physics, Elmer Hutchison, you can see some of the memos that start flying around various committees in AIP. Again, this is not to say this is inappropriate. It's interesting to watch the keen political instincts and skills of people like leadership in the AIP, saying we have an unprecedented opportunity to influence public opinion greatly. Now people care about what we've been saying for a while. You know, let's take advantage. Hans Bethe, soon to win the Nobel Prize, already a past president, American Physical Society, he starts repeating DeWitt's ratio 2 to 3 times in these, he was called on to give a great many sort of public lectures, radio addresses, responding to Sputnik in the weeks and months afterwards. What I love, and his papers are still at the Cornell Library. What I love is you can see these TypeScript notes for the text from which you would read. And in the margins, in pencil, he's written things like, where did that number come from again? I should check on that. But speech after speech, the number stays, and he never did the homework. So he already has something worried about it, but it was indeed so effective. Then you can see the media, it just laps this up even more vigorously than they had before Sputnik. There's a lovely book by John Rudolph where you can read more about this. I have a short piece in a recent article as well. Now we come to that third step, that feedback loop that the economist Robert Shiller told us about. Again, many things to isolate. Here's one that I'll talk about briefly. The National Defense Education Act, which was enacted less than 1 year after Sputnik, which is sort of breakneck pace for getting major legislation passed then or now from Congress. Eisenhower signs it into law in September 58, authorizing $1 billion, roughly $7 billion today, outrageous for the fiscally conservative Eisenhower, a great reservations about it, but it became a political necessity. And in fact, this was the first federal aid to education of its kind in a century. The last time the U.S. federal government interceded this way in education was when they set up what's basically the land-grant college system from the 1862. There's a long-standing tradition, it's like the third rail of American politics, not to intervene in education, which is seen as a particularly local affair, school boards, you know, not Congress people. So it bucks that trend. Over the first 4 years, this NDEA winds up giving out 7,000 graduate fellowships, which is an order of magnitude more than what had been available before. That's a large jump. About 500,000 fellowships for undergraduates. Additional block grants, which are all pinged to incentives to increase enrollments in certain fields, in the so-called defense fields of science, math, engineering, and language studies, as long as it's Russian or related sort of helpful fields. Indeed, we start seeing, in fact, here's another normalized graph. Blue is all PhDs in all fields for this time period. Red is physics, we saw that got this huge bump out of the war and still is among the fastest growing after the war. Engineering finally overtakes it in terms of rates of growth, thanks to this NDEA, which now folds in engineering as well as physics. The NDEA's closest observer, a historian, wrote an entire book just about the legislative history of how this thing went from, you know, reported out of one committee, went to another committee, what lobbying had to go on. It's a whole book just on this act. And she concludes, it's a very, very useful, fascinating book, she concludes that these proponents were, quote, willing to strain the evidence to establish a new policy. Again, this was a not evil, in fact, a quite mundane example of politics at work. We have facts on the ground that can be mobilized in all kinds of ways. And here we get a feedback where you start overfilling the classrooms that are already overfilled. Now, why have I hammered on this so long? These reports that I mentioned by DeWitt, by Carl, several hundred pages, these were not classified reports. They were paid for partly clandestinely, but they were published in DeWitt's case by the National Science Foundation, in Carl's case by the MIT Press, hardly, you know, a difficult source to find. They're still in most libraries, you know, in academic libraries in the United States and beyond. If anyone had sat down and read these books, right, they might have found some interesting things. That even aside from all these caveats that I mentioned, the numbers themselves, even just the numbers, deserved a closer look at the time. That ratio that became so famous, 2 to 3 times, was computed for very particular reasons that we can talk about, by DeWitt. They were by binning together a series of fields that were then, the details of which were sort of written out of all the press coverage. The fields involved were labeled as engineering and applied sciences. What that meant in practice was engineering of all flavors, agriculture, and health. Not natural sciences, not mathematics, for example. And now if we think for a moment and say, well, I mean, this is being mobilized to say the Soviets have more people who can make bombs and missiles than us, and that's why we need to catch up quickly. It's a national security argument. And we realize they're actually counting agriculturalists and basically nurses and some medical doctors. And you think about the recent tragic history in the Soviet Union of collective farming. You think about the agriculturist Trofim Lysenko, who's shown here, and the disastrous effects of Lysenkoism on Soviet biology. Why on earth should these have been the relevant categories to latch onto? And in fact, if you go back to the equally explicit, equally easy to find pages a few pages later in DeWitt's book, and bin together some different categories, he also charts natural sciences, physics, chemistry, and as well as mathematics. Then the Soviet lead, there's still Soviet lead in just raw degrees per year, including all those extension schools and so on. But the lead, the size of the lead has fallen by a factor of 10. Now they have a roughly 20% lead per year, and that's inflated by half the students being male, you know, through the male students, rather than a 2 to 3, you know, a 300 to 400 times difference. And so these numbers can be made to tell all kinds of stories, and none of that, of course, made it into any sort of larger scale discussions. Now, so what? Isn't it good to get more money to train more scientists? I'm all for expanding scientific education. But let's keep our eyes open to what comes from this. If it's built up on, let's face it, a kind of, you know, a house of cards, then it can become especially unstable to rapid changes in priorities and conditions in finances and so on. To make a very long story short, there's at least one or two chapters in the book on this slide, so I'll go quickly. Vietnam War happens, right? We'll remember that. And that has all kinds of effects on this science policy arrangement, which had held relatively steadily for 15 or 20 years. There is the famous campus protests, which were largely protesting the military's purported influence on campus. That was almost always taking over physics buildings, the bombing at, that killed a few people at Madison, Wisconsin, killed physicists, even though they were aiming for this Army Math Center. At Columbia University, there were pipe bombs being planted, some of which didn't even go off, in Pupin Laboratory years after 1968, 1969, even 72, 73, and the physicists would make fun of the bomb makers who couldn't even make the pipe bombs go off. And we can, it's sort of eerie to read these reports after 9/11, but sort of domestic terrorism was alive and well, at least in these fits and starts. And the Vietnam War also, of course, bled out a great deal of money. So federal funding on domestic programs starts to dry up rapidly. Again, that's a well-known, you'll probably know that. Education spending starts going to tail nosedail. Domestic spending from the Defense Department starts to decline rapidly, too. And again, I'll be happy to say more about this if people are interested. The last thing is that draft deferment rules change. So until 1967, undergraduates in good standing could get a deferment. That goes away because they now the escalation of troops in Vietnam is needed. 1969, deferments for PhD students are taken away, too. So all these, it's a perfect storm. All these sort of political and economic and military things overlap in time, and the end result is a very quick reversal of national priorities. The priority is no longer get more physics students in the classroom. That is indeed to say, get a large number of them into booths. So priorities shift. Again, every field goes into decline. Draft deferments affect grad students in all fields, but physics kids get hit the hardest. It was dependent almost uniquely in the United States on Pentagon funding at this point for good basic science, not just making widgets or weapons. But even basic science was funded at the 96% level in the United States by Pentagon sources. Less money in the system, they're most of them. They don't have a diversified portfolio, we might say. And let's see what happens. The American Institute of Physics ran a job placement registry. They would try to, a clearinghouse to connect students and potential employers to help arrange interviews at national meetings, annual meetings, and so on. As even into the mid-1960s, there were more jobs than students. It was boom times on the physics frontier. That balance tips by the late 60s, and then the bottom falls out. So I always say the job market is just a hellish bear today, but my goodness, 1,000 sins for 50 jobs on register. That's what I mean by the bottom falling out. And so if this curve looks familiar, if the shape of that curve looks familiar, you're not wrong. We've seen it. We've seen that shape of that curve many times, even more recently. So looking, for example, again at NASDAQ or sort of tech stocks in the much more famous recent bubble. So that's what I want to say about this speculative bubble. Now I want to say move to the second part of the talk. So what? Now, does this matter to the world of ideas? Does it touch the stuff of knowledge and not just affect, you know, cohorts who all of a sudden are thrown out of grad school with no job prospects? And I want to suggest to you it does in some perhaps surprising ways. So the way I want to focus on this is by looking at the teaching of quantum mechanics at the sort of first year graduate student level. It's only after World War II in the United States where quantum mechanics moves to the center of the physics curriculum. Originally moves there for graduate students and then very rapidly sort of seeps down to become the center even for undergraduate training. In 1939 and 40, very good students got PhDs from very good programs in the United States without ever having been taken a course in quantum mechanics from Berkeley, from Cornell, right? And that changes very quickly after World War II, as we can talk about. And so one measure of the importance, you can look at a kind of market response. Look at the number of quantum mechanics textbooks published. That's these bars. And here in the background is that mountain of these degrees being given. You can see the booksellers know what's happening and all kinds of indications like that. So quantum mechanics, I argue, is actually the best place to look at sort of epistemic effects. It's the one course that's required in every single department in the country. Some departments are dropping thermodynamics as a requirement. E&M is there or not there. Everyone has quantum mechanics as a requirement. Now again, in this room, you'll know this. There's another quick slide. The architects of quantum mechanics, largely working in Central Europe, some in Britain, 1920s and 30s, many of them had been very, very vociferous, saying quantum mechanics is not just a set of equations. It is that, and they are beautiful. But it's also an emerging worldview. It is at root a philosophical investigation. Now, we don't have to agree with that, with their appraisal. But there's no doubt that that's how they talked about it and believed it. They meant it. They filled the first generation of textbooks by people like Bohr and Heisenberg, Max Born, and even the relatively unphilosophical Arnold Sommerfeld. Go back to their textbooks, almost all are translated into English very quickly, and there are whole sections, sometimes whole chapters, on basically quantum mechanics and philosophy. That this is seen as an essential part. Look at their lecturing at the time as well. And now they won't all give the same philosophical response. Some will point to Immanuel Kant. Some say, no, we've learned from Ernst Mach. Wolfgang Pauli enters in a very a deep and long-standing correspondence with Carl Jung, the psychoanalyst. Others take Eastern traditions quite seriously. Bohr, especially Schrodinger, reads deeply in what we might call Eastern mysticism, Eastern religions. Whatever their favorite target, it's a philosophical investigation. the fall determinism, the things that we would all know in this room. These things demand an engagement on many levels at once. Equations, yes. Worldviews, yes. Everything in between. What might be surprising to you, it surprised me, the first generation of sort of quantum Americans, which sounds like a comic book hero, but the quantum Americans here I'll talk about, that first generation, agreed in principle. They agreed as well, this is a philosophical endeavor as much as a technical calculational one. They disagreed on which philosophies to go to. So almost uniquely, the Americans turned to one of our own, Percy Bridgman, the Harvard thermodynamics expert, who had his own very elaborate philosophical program. He spelled out in a series of books, very influential. Look at the first generation of textbooks on quantum mechanics written by US-based physicists. Condon and Morse comes out in 1929, Edwin Kemble, Harold Urey, and others. And again, they'll have sections, paragraphs, even in some cases chapters on why Bridgman's philosophy helps us make sense of quantum mechanics. Again, they're not saying it's Kant, but they're saying it's some. We need some overt philosophical engagement to make sense of this new work. Look at unpublished lecture notes from the period, which are hard to find. Some persist. Robert Oppenheimer's very famous course at Berkeley, the notes of which were copied down, typed up, hectographed, sort of pre-mimeographed, circulated. They're still in many libraries across the country. They're sold at cost for $1.50. And you can see them spreading out. They're still in libraries. Oppenheimer, again, is saying this material demands as much an engagement in kind of interpretation and speculation as it does in terms of, before he puts the Schrodinger equation on paper, he has a whole series of discussions about interpretive matters and why they stick with us. Yeah, Paul. Graduate. It's usually not in the undergraduate classrooms yet. This is the 1930s still. Oppenheimer's course becomes so influential, there's one grad student at Berkeley who goes on a hunger strike because until Oppie relents and lets her take the course for a fourth time. And that's how influential this stuff was, right? And indeed, Felix Bloch's notes survived. Pockets of these notes survive. Look at things like oral exams, exams to advance to PhD standing, or written general exams. My favorite example here comes from Caltech. Caltech maintained a kind of in-house series of notebooks between 1929 and 1969. It's extraordinary. And these became, Caltech only had orals, no written. And so these notebooks were for students to sort of, right immediately after their exams, give a kind of narration for future students about what their exam was like, how they prepared for it, what even very particular, what specific questions were asked by this professor versus that professor. And then, they become very playful. They get narrated as boxing matches, and then he jabbed me with this question about thermodynamics or military campaigns. He cut me off of the team. And they become very so self-consciously very fun to read, kind of student notes. But they're an extraordinary resource to see what is expected for all Caltech PhD students to be able to pass through. And in the 1930s, there are many, many questions, student after student, in these communal books about, again, we'd say sort of philosophical engagement of some kind. Written exams survive from other places, and they feature many long essay questions, not just calculational ones. Book reviews for the latest textbooks. They will often disagree with the particular philosophical approach advanced by, say, Condon and Morse, but they'll agree that it needs some philosophical view, right? So this is an accepted and a valued part of what it means to conquer this new material. It vanishes. It's like it's just a vanishing set of material roughly within one decade after the end of World War II. And again, we can measure that by the same measures. Look at lecture notes, which survives. I'll say more about in a moment. Look at textbooks with these oral exams or the written general exams, problem sets. The best soundbite comes from MIT's Hermann Feschbach, who finally says, he throws his hands up, enough with this musty atavistic to-do about position and momentum. Let's get on and teach our students how to calculate. The book reviews in places like American Journal of Physics Today, Science, start now praising the textbooks which have most carefully dropped philosophy. These are now terms of praise, not terms of despair, as you read from the whole reviews. Go back to Caltech, because I love these books. There's one student in 1953 who's just scandalized as soon as he comes out of his exam, because he'd read 20 plus years worth of these notes from his former from students who'd come before. He'd worked on all these sort of, as he calls them, queer logical points and paradoxes. He wanted to talk through the grand mysteries, the metaphysics at the heart of modern physics. And he comes out of this, and they just made me calculate the hydrogen spectrum. I wasted all that time. The best advice another student says is memorize and rehearse the stock problems, because by now, by the late 50s, there is now a stock set of problems that every student must learn how to solve, and there's virtually none of this sort of grander talk. General exams elsewhere, I mentioned, used to feature essays, and now they become very narrowly calculational. In fact, Stanford gets so overwhelmed with so many students at once, their written general exams become a series of true-false exams. Can you imagine advancing to candidacy because you answered, you know, 25 true false questions. Now, they're not easy exams, but you know, you don't even have to calculate anything. I mean, at least overtly, you don't have to show your calculations. Because it's too, anything else is too hard for them to grade under the onslaught of students. Now, this sort of widespread pragmatism has been noted by many physicists, many historians and philosophers of science. The sort of post-war pragmatism of the US science community, especially the physicists, is by now well known. And there are many sort of pet explanations out there that I'd be happy to say more about. I'll go through them quickly. One is sort of a straw man. Well, maybe all those puzzles were solved. Maybe we know how to interpret quantum mechanics. And of course, everyone in the room will know that that's obviously not right. We still have open questions now that are by no means solved by consensus. It wasn't that everything was solved. Okay, then we get to more sort of historically rich answers. Maybe the war in between had sort of forged all these physicists into pragmatists. They just spent 3 or 4 years very intensely making gadgets, talking with engineers, talking with military personnel. They weren't in these ivory towers philosophizing, and maybe that just changed their orientation. That certainly has some merit as an explanation, is radically incomplete. If you just go to empirically, who taught in what style around the country, what was their war experience and so on, plenty of people who in fact headed whole divisions at Oak Ridge, for example, at Los Alamos, at the Rad Lab, went back to the classrooms and in fact tried to continue in this sort of pre-war philosophical vein, and they turned in rapidly into a small minority. It's not just the war. Okay, maybe it's this post-war patronage I mentioned. Maybe it's the fact that the Pentagon is now paying for virtually all research, and that for the first time in the United States in the mid-50s, more physics students get jobs in industry rather than academia. It's a rather important shift that happens in exactly this period. Maybe if you're working for Bell Labs or Westinghouse or other smaller industrial concerns, these sort of academic niceties are less important. So again, that's an empirical question. I looked at 300 or 400 graduates from these departments in these years, and there's no correlation between where they got their jobs and the style of course they had gone through at their departments. It can't just be sort of demand side changes or employment changes either. And I say this knowing full well I've now just dissed two of my main advisors whom I otherwise greatly admire, Sam as his marvelous book and Peter Gallison too. I think their explanations have great merit, and I think they're not all the way there. That's not so bad. So then let's look at what traces survive. And here it's a very frustrating question. Now I'm looking not just for published textbooks, but for these sort of ephemera of academic life. Not just course syllabi, but actually full-blown lecture notes, either taken by students or in some cases taken by, or you know, prepared by the faculty. It's a mixed bag. I was able to find through the internet age, you can now find these pockets, and they're often mimeographed lectures that exist in one or two libraries, request them through interlibrary loan. So now this is one way that the internet helps history of physics. You can find them where they exist. And I could get about a dozen. And at first, you thought, that sounds really small. Then you realize there were 52 departments, only 52 departments in the US at this time, granting PhDs in physics. So then you say, maybe that's a reasonable sample after all. These are all from roughly the same time. So at that time, it's not quite a quarter of the sort of relevant graduate training departments. They fall out starkly into these two groups. So here's a little econometrics for you. If you look at the enrollments, which can be reconstructed in all kinds of ways, how many bums were in the seats in those classes? There's one group that is still very small, and it's becoming a minority. It's fewer in the sample that are this small. And they're about 3 times smaller on average than the other group, whose enrollment is nearly 40 per class. And that grows rapidly. So MIT, by 1962, their course has 100 students in it. First-year graduate-level course, 100 students. Berkeley's is 80 or so. But in this earlier period, 5 years before that, the average comes out closer to 40. And then, now here's the cheat. His numbers can be made to lie, as I've suggested to you. I've gone through and self-coded, you know, how much interpretive material is in each of these sets of lecture notes. Now, I grant you that's a fuzzy category. I'm willing to open up these notebooks and have you code them. But even if you think I'm twice too generous here and half as generous here, change both of them by factor 2, they still don't overlap. It's still statistically significant. These are just radically different, you know, samples. And they don't correlate with job demand, they don't correlate with patronage in that department, they correlate, so far as I can tell, only with enrollments. This was not entirely lost on physicists at the time. First of all, think about it in our own experiences. What can you do in a classroom this size versus stadium seating like this? I mean, they were teaching at Berkeley in auditorium that held 300 graduate students soon. What do you do? What pedagogically can be encouraged in these two settings? And again, this is not just me doing a thought experiment. A couple physicists reflected on this very overtly at the time, in places like Physics Today or the American Journal of Physics, devoted to sort of pedagogical issues in training young physicists. So one of them says, with these subjects, sort of core, juicy philosophical nuggets, lecturing is of little avail. The baffled student hardly knows what to write down, and what notes he does take are almost certain to horrify the instructor. Better, he says, to stick with problem sets that at least you can grade, right? On the other hand, one of these small, one from this sort of small classroom sample emphasizes what choices were made about what topics to cover. He said, well, we talked about it in class. The role of classroom discussions helped change, in fact, the content of the course. So that's a kind of synchronic slice. Limited, of course. A small sample, I'd like to be larger. But it's indicative, if not definitive. Then I want to do a kind of longer, a longitudinal sweep. And so now I went to more published records. Physicists based in the United States published 33 textbooks during this 30-year period, all aimed for exactly the same audience, all on quantum mechanics, all for first-year graduate-level quantum mechanics. There were, of course, many books coming out for undergraduates, many for more advanced topics for graduate students. But for this one self-defined category, in their prefaces, in their reviews, saying this is good for this type of class, 33 fit, I think, unambiguously as meant for first-year graduate students. And these contain a total of over 6,000 problems. This is why God made RAs. They could like, Xerox all the problems for me. Obviously, there are lots of duplicates. It's not 6,000 unique problems. It's about probably 400 unique problems, but you know, with little iterations. But there's a large base there. And then what I went through is to say how many of those 6,000 problems required the students to use subjects and verbs, to write little essays or little paragraphs, as opposed to give only an algebraic or calculative answer. And in fact, you see, that's what's graphed in this graph below, that while this booming enrollments is riding high, the proportion stays low and kind of wiggles around a little bit. Soon after the enrollments crash, you start seeing these new books from the mid-70s that are as high as 50% essay questions in the embedded problems. And again, you see, it's not just me saying this. This is noted and talked about both in sort of published reviews, often saying it's a good thing, by the way. So finally, we got rid of that flaky, fuzzy philosophy stuff. But also, there's a marvelous set of behind-the-scenes negotiations. One of the major textbook publishers, McGraw-Hill, had, as you know, a long-standing series in pure and applied physics where many of these textbooks came out. Their physics editor was Leonard Schiff, the physics department chair at Stanford. He was editor for that series for about 15 years. And in his papers, you see this marvelous collection of all the incoming and outgoing correspondence between authors, referees, publishers about what makes the ideal textbook and how it becomes a moving target. And you can see, again, I write about this in more detail in the book, but you can see they're worrying about phasing out anything that smells of a waste of time philosophy and making sure there's more and more problems in there. There's also, I should say, a great deal of accumulation of skill. Look at the problems that are in, say, the third edition of Schiff's book, which comes out in 1968. These are heads and shoulders hard, just raw, harder problems than in the first edition in 1949. Entering grad students in the late 60s could be expected, reasonably expected, to do problems that would have been sort of publishable as original research not all that long before. So this is by no means, I'm not making this a dumbing down. It is, in fact, a ramping up of one type of skill rather than another. These are becoming incredibly skillful calculators, but in one direction, not the other. Now, again, I'd be happy to say more in questions. Very briefly, take my word for it, there's more to be said. These enrollment curves look astonishingly similar, both for PhDs in physics in Canada and the UK. This one shows sort of accumulated labor force, not quite degrees, Soviets and US, counting only physicists and mathematicians. You see, at every step of the way, we had a 2-to-1 lead in physics and math, not 2 to 3 times less. But the rates of growth are remarkably parallel, both all out of proportion to, say, raw demographics. Look at the textbooks published in each of those settings, and again, grosso modo, they look a lot like the American books. They have some juicy philosophy sections before the war, before the enrollments boom, and even in the Soviet Union, where the ideological tests from the party are actually weakened after the war. Stalin really wants a nuke, so he doesn't do Lysenkoism to the physicists. He stops these sort of philosophers looking over the shoulders. And yet their books have less sort of philosophical engagement than ever before. Look at Landau-Lifshitz's books have even fewer interpretive problems than their U.S. Counterparts at the same time. Look at Western Europe, again, roughly speaking. There's far less enrollment pressure right after the war. There's much more basic rebuilding going on. The quantum mechanics books that do come out still have long sections of philosophy, well into the late 50s, early 1960s. Albert Masaya's book is reviewed, I cut out the quotation, as being sort of overdone and exhausting and irrelevant by some of the leading American book reviewers for having even more philosophy in it than the pre-war ones did. And the few that indeed did include problems at all, most European books still didn't include problem sets. The ones that did had 3 times more essay questions than the U.S. ones. So at least there's a correlation, if not a cause, right? It seems to hold up. Now, very briefly to say, people always ask, well, I truncate that graph in 1980. What happens? Well, what happens, I think, rather tragically, is we do the whole thing over again, right, in the United States. So here again is US PhDs in physics per year. Now, to go back to Paul's earlier question, in this bubble, fully one half of those PhD students are non-US citizens. That's the one major difference. Otherwise, everything is sort of a redo, it's a do-over. So we reach virtually the same post-Sputnik high very quickly by, and again, many of the causes are similar. As you'll know, a Reagan administration build-up in defense spending goes up very rapidly. Large projects like the Strategic Defense Initiative or Star Wars are one part of a large portfolio. The one addition here is that in the 80s, there was also an extra economic language incentive, which is we're not just losing against the Soviets militarily, we're endangered by the Japanese economically. This is the rise of kind of a great wave of fear about the economic supremacy of Japan because they purportedly were training many more scientists and engineers per capita than we were. There's a marvelous essay that came out not long after this period by an Asian studies specialist, Earl Kinmonth, who goes through the same analysis I tried to present to you for the Soviet studies earlier, says every one of those claims was at least flimsy. It was based on unstable numbers and category errors. Now, I haven't looked at the Japanese materials as the same, but reading that article is quite stunning. More recently, there's a very nice book by Juan Lucena, who's now doing history and sociology of science. Juan was at the time working in the U.S. National Science Foundation in their sort of supply and demand tracking center. It was once called the Education and Manpower Division. It had a different name by this point. But he worked there and then wrote this book, actually came out a couple of years ago, to look at the sort of Reagan-era modeling in the NSF for what was called the pipeline. It was classic Reaganomics. There was literally no input in the models for demand. It was all supply-side economics. In fact, I should say Eric Weinstein has a marvelous essay on this era, too, a sort of Sami's dot. It's floating on the web. I don't think it's come out yet, but it's a marvelous, we should ask him questions, too. He's a real expert on this second wave of science policy, sort of misguided, I think it's fair to say. Please, yeah. Thank you. The short version was, again, these numbers at least deserve a closer look. I think we'll certainly agree on that, right? And so now, again, we know what happens. A few years into this, the Berlin Wall falls in November 1989. A year and a half later, Soviet Union dissolves. A year and a half, 2 years later, the SSC is killed. I mentioned on LHC Day, right? So a month after I entered graduate school in physics, a very well-meaning professor called me and saying, if that vote goes the wrong way, you should leave. I said, well, I just got here. I kind of like it here. I got an apartment. I'm working on inflation. This has nothing to do with, sort of TEV scales. How's your Jun? And he said, you don't get it. There'll be no money, no jobs. And he left a year later to go to Wall Street, where he was no doubt happy for a while. So we have these bubbles where, again, you have a tremendous buildup for all kinds of reasons, not all of them bad reasons, but they were, I should say, insufficiently examined, and then a kind of instability where we have a very rapid fall off with the end of the Cold War. Now, again, does this matter? As I tried to say before, I'm not saying one style is good, one style is bad. We need really, really good calculational skills, and those students by the textbooks of the late 60s clearly had a generational advantage over what came before. And is not dumbing down, I want to make that clear. It is choosing both one set of research topics and one broader, we might say, epistemic style, one approach to what it means to do physics that can sort of take dominance for these perhaps unexamined reasons. And we could say, if we run a kind of a counterfactual, well, would quantum information sciences have taken off as robustly 20 or 30 years earlier had there been a continuing engagement with a kind of philosophical vein? No one paid attention to Bell's theorem or entanglement in the United States or even in many places elsewhere, in Bell's day, in the mid-60s, through the mid-70s, and arguably even not even the 80s, track citations, it blows up the same way this curve blows up. We're looking at the second bubble bursting. I don't know if Michael Nielsen's here, so Michael maybe can have a better example. We can talk about it afterwards. But the great work that's coming out, like Michael's work on the quantum computing, is really, I think, perhaps at least partly coming to the fore because conditions had indeed changed so rapidly and radically. I think Lee makes very similar points in his book about why certain approaches to, say, gravitational energy theory might take precedence at one time or another. Sort of resource allocation should at least be on the table. So I'd be happy to talk more about this. I'm not making those as strong claims. I think they line up at least. Okay, let me very, very briefly go through the third part. Is this unique to physics? No. Here's one example. A number of undergraduate degrees in the United States in computer science is NSF data. Actually, I don't know why it's truncated there. I'll go back to look at more recent numbers. But you see a very similar exponential rise, an equally symmetrical fall. And now this is ongoing, but my preliminary study seems to show from textbooks and syllabi and so on, introductory undergraduate courses in computer science in the United States before the mid-1980s were a lot about things like theories of computation. You know, the Turing test, not quite Gödel's theorem, but NP-incomplete problems and so on. What does it mean to compute? Does this challenge our notion of human rationality? And by the mid to late 80s, it's shut up, kid, does your code compile, right? Can you handle the problem sets? Maybe that's a little too stark, but the trend seems indeed to hold up, to at least correlate with these enrollment trends. And now, what about today? Everyone in the room knows the hot area should be biotech. We should all have seen this coming. So look at number of PhDs in biotech granted in the United States per year. It's more than quadrupled in two decades. This is an annual, not a cumulative, but an annual number. Now, we've seen curves like that. Will that pop here? I don't know, but it is indeed likely to pop. Are there intellectual trade-offs which we should be already aware of or attuned to in this sort of hyper-frenzy of buildup? I'm not saying we shouldn't build up in biotech. I'm saying let's have our eyes open. So let me conclude. First, and I think foremost, we need to treat all these sort of numbers stories with extraordinary care. We all know that we can sort of lie or obfuscate with numbers. And here in these sort of labor market analyses, I think they're especially ripe for even unintended biases or twistings. And so when we go back to these gathering storm type arguments, let's look at those numbers quite carefully. What are the assumptions? What are the categories? And then finally say, so what? It seems that a great deal more is at stake than only unstable labor markets, which is already bad enough. Having 1,000 unemployed PhDs at a given year is not a good thing we aim for. But I think it goes even deeper, even epistemically. It touches, I think, the sort of world of ideas in ways that can have lasting and perhaps unanticipated consequences. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. Good. That is a marvelous question. And I thought that too, and it happens in this case to be wrong, but it makes perfect sense. It does say the ignoring of things like entanglement or sort of making EPR measurements in real experiments, those are being done the first ones are being done a decade before ASPE, right? So John Clauser did these in 1972, published in 1972, PRL, not in some unknown journal, Physical Review Letters. And even John now says the technology to do that was that experiment was very nearly done by accident in 1950. And if you go back to the Wu Shaknov experiment, actually published in 1949, they didn't think to rotate the relative angle, but they were doing exactly the same correlation experiments for a different reason. They were testing positronium ideas from John Wheeler. But would that have been at the same confidence levels, the same efficiency detectors? Of course not. But to get a rough cut, could have been done at least technologically, at least 20 years early. In fact, people in 1927 were publishing the Physical Review experiments where they could get single photons through a double slit. They could already do sort of beam filtering in 1927 to be able to handle this. Now, again, the detector efficiency is nowhere where we'd want them today, but it seems not to have been uniquely a technological barrier. And in fact, it was instead people like Clauser or Ed Fry at Texas A&M were applying to the NSF for grants in this early 70s when a bubble had burst, getting turned down, saying it's a waste of time, plus there's no money. They're appealing in some cases to private funders, some of whom come through. And then they're ignored. So the year after Clauser's first experiment is published in 72, global citations of Bell's theorem fall in half. They were already small. They go from like 7 to 3. I mean, this is, and they don't bounce back up. It's not just fluctuations. They stay low. Go to 1982. Aspect finally publishes two articles in PhysRev Letters in 1982. Now we've got them. We close these loopholes, right? It's a marvelous, beautiful experiment. It was astonishingly clever. And global citations of Bell's theorem are flat for more than a decade afterwards. They make virtually no impact, at least as measured by citations, right? So I had thought, indeed, it was a technological limit. But it seems that might have played some role. That can't be the whole explanation. It's certainly a good intuition. But. Right. Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. That's right. I don't have that slide handy. I think the answer is actually no. And as I have normalized them in some Excel spreadsheet, I can try to call up here. You're certainly right that you want to be looking at the growth in the number of PhD-producing departments, which had tripled between the end of World War II and the first boom busting in 1970. But if you look at, say, rates of rise and fall vis-a-vis all PhDs in all fields, if you take a rough normalization there, these are all growing again. These are very well fit by exponential curves. The R-squareds are 0.96, 0.97, like Harry's saying. We never get that in social sciences. They're clearly exponentials, and they start just comparing exponentials, you know, doubling times or the exponents, and they're just, they're you know, quite qualitatively different. It's an important point, and certainly this is one quick graph to get the point across. But I think it's not. I don't think the effect goes away. I'll just put it that way. Eric, yeah. Oh, okay, yeah. No, that, as you know, Eric, it should have been quite obvious by now, I ain't no economist, right? So, I mean, I will gladly cede that to you. As you know, I mean, we've talked before, I've been talking a lot with people like Richard Freeman, who, as you know, were among the experts in trying to model these things early on, these economists trying to model the scientific and technical labor market. Or, as we talk about, a demographer, a very gifted person, Michael Teitelbaum. Teitelbaum points out, as we've talked about, his article came out even before this National Academy study, it speaks equally well to it afterwards, that there's this great hue and cry about a horrible shortage of technically trained people in the United States, and yet salaries for scientists and engineers in the United States have been flat, sometimes even falling below inflation, I believe. It's certainly not beating inflation during this whole time when people are saying there's a shortage. Well, economists would say that probably means it's not that much of a shortage, right, because you think salaries would have to go up. If demand has increased suddenly but supply has stayed flat, right? I learned that much from the economics. And second, Teitelbaum says the average rates of unemployment in the sort of science technology market and the whole U.S. labor market were the same, and so proportionally the same. They were both at that time 5.5%, whatever they were. They seemed perfectly in keeping with the general labor force. So I'm happy to change the text there. That was I take your point that indeed these shortages are, we should take the shortage notion off the table altogether. I see that. I wouldn't argue too hard. Yeah.
Yes.
And fall away when times are good in other venues.
That's right.
Is there any impact on these graphs?
I think the answer is it all correlates, right? I don't think we tell a different story that way. And partly why, I mean, if we go back to that very brief sort of Vietnam era slide, which tried to pack much too much in one slide, you know, all things are, as I say, all these effects are hitting at once. I think that's why it was certainly a steeper decline than that second bubble, and quite a sharp one. Almost there. This is the earliest stirrings of what we call stagflation. So the country as a whole has just less money going around, right, roughly speaking. Eric can correct that phrase. But it's certainly economic hardships falling. Less money in the mix, and more importantly, policy-wise, less money being intentionally directed towards that or this or that activity. So there's less money in the mix and less money being earmarked specifically to make more scientists and engineers. And these things overlap. I actually made up a graph for a separate talk about applications to the history of science, which one would think should be equally large as applications for physics departments, right? That's my next goal. But you know, this obviously much smaller specialized market, but there again, you certainly see correlations that are all too eerily perfect between moments of officially declared recessions in the U.S. economy and the increase in degrees. I don't have admissions, but just degrees granted. You know, tag for 5 or 6 years down the line, you see, oh, there it went, oh, there it goes down. So I absolutely agree that that's clearly at play here too. I don't know, I haven't gone back to try to say, is this, you know, 30% of the explanation or 70% of the explanation, I don't know. In this case, it's everything hit at once. It's just, I mean, this is just the wheels come off the bus, right? So in this example, just everything's wrong at the wrong time. Whether that would help us disentangle the late 80s, early 90s, it might be. I mean, I should look at it. It's a good question. Yes. I mean, again, as you know, Harry, I mean, a lot has been written among us crazy historians and sociologists that sort of the Cold War is the explanation for the death of the SSC, for example. Now, we can do an awful lot of actually very careful history, legislative history, which panels report out to which places and so on, where that clearly is part of the explanation. I wouldn't want to say that's the whole thing, but I mean, of course, that's the parallel to this situation. This is, you know, the beginning of the era of détente. It certainly wasn't the Cold War was over, but there was a very self-conscious rethinking of national military and sort of spending priorities, which is not dissimilar from what happened circa 1991 to 94. Right, I think that's right. As people in this room will know, in inflation-adjusted dollars, in real dollars, the year that the SSC was killed, all appropriations in the U.S. for energy physics across everything fell by 50% in 1 year, one half cut in 1 year, and then continued to fall versus inflation after that, much more gradually. So right, these things obviously matter. Yes. Yes. The short answer is, of course, I don't know. I mean, I have knee-jerk reactions to this. This goes on in not just biotech. I mean, MIT, many places have these sort of ethics initiatives. Sometimes they're mandated by federal grants. You know, it's not just by choice. And ethics, at least MIT, often means sort of bullet points. You know, this is not exactly going back to read Immanuel Kant's ethics, right, by a long shot, or any sort of recognizable philosophical program in ethics or morality. We have some philosophers in the room. I don't think this is what they would sniff and say, oh, that's ethics, right? What I'd say is we should get Harry or Harry's students, we should get some sociologists in the ground now to be studying this. I don't have a real-time answer. I have my suspicions.